Our next presenter, Dr. Kay Comtois, is going to tell you about some pretty exciting data and a very exciting program that speaks to some of the issues that we started to get at this morning when we talked about longer-term outcomes and the differences between improvement and what we might call reliable change as opposed to real recovery and independent living and reemployment and so forth. And Dr. Comtois is really the leader in this. She's developed the DBT ACEs program, which she's going to tell you about. Kate is an associate professor here in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at the University of Washington, where you've been for years and years, starting as a postdoc working with Marsha Linehan. And in addition to running this program, developing it and running it and researching it and working within the Department of Psychiatry and the residency program and the internship program. So she's indefatigable and also is a terrific trainer and supervisor. So I'm very happy to introduce Dr. Kate Comtois.
Is this picking up? You can hear in the back? Yes? Okay. So hi, yes, I'm Kate Comtois. I want to talk to you a little bit about our DBT ACEs program. So my plan is to try to give you a little bit of context in which we developed the program, talk a little bit about the differences from standard DBT, which are not very big, but I think they're important, and specifically some of the important considerations for doing individual therapy and skills coaching in the context of our model. So I work at Harborview Mental Health Services. So for those of you who are local, you probably know what this is. If not, Harborview is our large county hospital here in Seattle. We kind of, our mission population is everybody who it's hard to get services somewhere else, HIV populations, the poor, people from other countries, people who are involved in the criminal justice system. And we're kind of the place you can come no matter what. And what I work in is our mental health and addiction services wing of the mental health center, which is all outpatient. So mental health center doesn't mean inpatient here. We have a wide range of programs, as you can see here, and our DBT program is embedded in our psychotherapy clinic down at Harborview. So let me give you a little bit of history for DBT at the Mental Health Center at Harborview. We are the first program that Marsha Linehan disseminated DBT to outside of her research clinic, and that was before my time. When I came in 1991 as a fellow, it was really the kind of the original model, really developed pre-manual. So all based on her original documents. Then in the 90s, she developed her manual, and we kind of developed as a program. And when I first came in, we weren't fully adherent to the model. I became a research therapist on one of her research studies, discovered how we weren't entirely adherent to the model, and kind of quickly rallied the troops around the idea that we've really got to be an adherent model and kind of developed our fully adherent DBT program. But what we found working with folks who have chronic disability, primarily, certainly at that time, primarily folks who were disabled and either on Medicaid or Medicare funding, that clients were becoming sort of stable mental patients. That is, they weren't working, they weren't leaving the mental health center, they weren't really finding any new friends, they were just really, things were quiet, They weren't trying to kill themselves. They weren't in the moment wanting to kill themselves very often. They weren't harming themselves. They weren't coming to our emergency rooms. But they also weren't having the life that they wanted to live. And so we tried adding another year of DBT, and that did not really seem to make any difference. So we really had a tough year in 1999 where two of our graduates who had been with us for the full 2 years committed suicide. And it really, for me, had a really profound effect on me. And I think our program as a whole, that this is just not okay. It's just not okay. I sort of looked at their lives and I thought, you know, we sort of promised folks a life worth living. Not really sure that either of them had it. And without that, asking someone to go on and on year after year is really asking a lot. So we really developed a new mission around helping people get off of disability and no longer be a mental patient, what has sort of come to be called recovery, a recovery model in the general community mental health system. So this is really an uphill battle. So there's only about 10 to 20% of folks who have severe mental health disorders in the United States who are competitively employed. And by competitively employed, I mean a job that any of us could get. So it's not in any kind of sheltered work situation. It doesn't mean that you're just working for your grandmother who wouldn't be hiring except you needed a job, right? But, you know, finding jobs on the open market. And it doesn't appear that this low unemployment rate is related to a lack of desire to work. So research has found that folks do actually want to work, and they want the financial independence, just like the rest of us, but also work is a primary mechanism for being integrated into life. You know, I've got a lot of suicidal patients who I treat down at Harborview, not all of them with DBT, some of them I treat with other models, but the thing that's sort of universal for folks who come to Harborview who are unemployed is that they're missing all of not only the financial benefits of work, but all of the community and connection benefits of work. When I think, you know, having been at Harborview now almost coming up on 20 years, this is, you know, a community for me. These are the people who know me. If I don't show up for work, people are like, hey, where's Kate? You know, there's people who would, you know, come out and find me and are interested in me. And that's something that so many of my patients don't have. They also think that work is incredibly difficult to do because they're constantly in the position of looking for work or thinking about work or otherwise sort of contemplating work or struggling around work. They're not actually working. And for those of us who've ever looked for a job as opposed to worked a job, you know that it's a lot easier to actually work the job. Right, but that's not the experience of most of the people I work with, is to be sort of connected with actually working a job. The folks who have severe mental illness are the largest group on federal disability in the United States. And compared with other disabilities, they are less likely to work even after vocational rehab services are provided. And they're less likely to terminate their disability payments and more likely to reapply for them. So one of the things we always keep in mind in our DBT ACEs program is the distinction between health insurance and the cash payments that people get for disability. Because the complexities of health insurance and having access to health insurance is a universal problem that all of us are facing and all of us struggle with. And, of course, they struggle with it, too. And if you had access to decent health insurance, you'd probably hang on to it tooth and nail. Too. I bet there's a lot of folks working jobs you don't want to work because that's where your health insurance lives, right? So that there's that piece. But there's also the piece of the amount of money that you're getting to live on, right? Which is having that money coming in is associated with people working less. And that's a bit more where we've kind of focused our attention. One of the reasons that is that about 28 to 40% of income that folks with psychiatric disabilities earned in previous studies was actually available to them. So if you're on disability, you're often living in a housing situation that's subsidized. You may be getting food stamps. You may be getting other governmental supports. You're certainly getting cash payments from the disability. As your income rises, you lose access to these. So it's not like if we go out at a job and we make $200 a week, we pay federal taxes or we pay state taxes or whatever, and then the rest is ours. That's not how it plays out for a lot of folks. And so when you see studies, you see that, like as in one qualitative study, 100% of those who were on SSDI and the majority on SSI, so these are the two main Social Security disability programs, consciously kept their earnings low, specifically below the level at which their disability payments are reviewed and potentially terminated. And they also report direct encouragement by clinical and vocational staff to do this, to stay in low-level part-time jobs so as not to jeopardize their disability. Now, this is a dialectical issue if there ever was one. Okay? So, do I think my folks should be homeless? No. Do I think there's a chance of it? Yes. If they don't have disability payments, there is a realistic, they have reason to worry. And many of my folks I work with have actually been homeless at one point or another. They have a very real idea of what this is like. Okay, so that's absolutely one side of the dialectic here. On the other side, when you look at the antithesis of this, if you keep your income so low, you tend to actually have a greater percentage of it taken away, right? It's just the way it plays out. That's how usually it plays out. And you're not really changing your standard of living in any substantial way. What we're seeing is until people jump up to at least 20 hours a week of competitive work, their overall income and standard of living are not changing in a very meaningful way. So that what often happens is people essentially remain in poverty. So what do we do about this? Well, the dominant employment evidence-based practice is supported employment, or they also call it individual placement and support. It's got 11 randomized controlled trials supporting that it increases employment. There are some clubhouse, assertive community treatment, and cognitive remediation interventions that also have a little bit of data, none of it replicated, for helping people be employed. But the model in supported employment is not to get off of disability at all, right? Oftentimes you see numbers of how much more money people are bringing in a month at about $110, okay? So this is additional work, but this is not living off of your earned income, right? And there's no data for borderline personality disorder in supported employment. And in fact, some places have actually clinically recommended, sort of said, oh, people with BPD shouldn't be included in this model. We're not sure this model works. We don't know that at this point. There's really been no study, so I actually don't know either way. But when we went to look and see what we should do, there wasn't anything to kind of step into. So we kind of developed it ourselves. So starting in 1999, we started developing and changing kind of informally in our program what we did with the second year. Essentially, we felt with the kind of problems the patients had when they originally came in to our program that we didn't want to change the first year substantially. So we focused on changing the second year. And by 2002, we kind of had a general idea of what was going on. And we did some pilot evaluation internally that it showed that it did appear to be working. Our patients were working substantially more than they used to be. So we applied for funding through NIMH for a small feasibility randomized controlled trial, which we've been working on for the last 4 years or so. And we published in Psychiatric Services last November our pilot data, which I will tell you about now. So this is our pilot data. So the four groups that you're seeing here are the year prior to SDBT is standard DBT. So we try to keep the first year. It's pretty darn close to the standard DBT program you've seen in any of the other publications. The second is at the end of that year. The third is at the end of the DBT ACEs year, which is a fixed 12-month program, so at the end of that year. And at the end of a year follow-up. So our folks had about 10% competitive employment or being enrolled in college or technical school at the beginning. That's pretty typical for folks funded through Medicaid and Medicare in our county. In fact, it's actually a tad bit lower. You can see that standard DBT itself has a really beneficial effect on employment, right? So it's a kind of core quality of life interfering behavior to be in poverty, to be unemployed, to not have those kind of social connections. So in standard DBT, often people go to work. But we did show a significant jump with in that from participating in the DBT ACEs program. And when we interviewed people a year afterward, about half of them were still competitively employed or in school. And, you know, this is, again, dialectical if there ever was one. When I first saw these numbers, I was like totally crushed. Like, what do you mean only 50%? And then other people say, yeah, but when you compare to the fact that in our county it's about 13%, this is a really drastic increase. So I really think this is a reflection of all of the natural barriers, which I'll talk to you about in a minute, all of the things that a person has to accomplish to live off of psychiatric disability when this has become their life. We also looked at how many folks were working competitively for 20 hours or more a week, which is our goal. So you can see that did go up, and there was a trend for that to remain up the year in the follow-up year. It's important to note in the follow-up year, folks did not have DBT. Certainly they did not have DBT with our program. Everybody is discharged at the end of the DBT ACEs 12 months. Some people sought some DBT in the community. I wouldn't say that was the majority of folks. I think some people got some. So obviously, if you're, maybe it's not obvious, we are, as a program, historically, we're funded by Medicaid and Medicare, which meant that it was impossible for people to actually keep our services if they lost their health insurance. So, sort of by definition, at the end of ACEs, they were 100% still in the public mental health system. A few people, our agency had sort of floated through our charity care program for the last several months because they're getting their jobs had led to them not having the insurance to pay us, and our agency said, yes, but this is because they're doing so well, and they sort of floated them out to the end of the year. And then we looked to see 1 year later how many people were enrolled in public mental health services, and it was only 36%. So that was something we were really happy about. What we really believe is that our folks are perfectly capable of living outside of the public mental health system, and that much of the way the public mental health system works in the Seattle-King County area is not particularly helpful to them, because it's very, very biologically based, counting on the medications to work, which I don't think is necessarily going to benefit most of the patients I work with, and case management. And by the end of ACEs, we wanted everybody to be their own case manager. So we didn't really see that people needed to have ongoing case management. Their overall life satisfaction, so one of the things we were worried about is, okay, so maybe they accomplish what we want them to accomplish, maybe they aren't so happy, right? They've sort of done what we wanted them to do and not gotten much out of it. So we used the quality of life interview that Tony Lehman developed. It's a 7-point scale. So one is life is absolutely terrible, and seven is I'm completely delighted with life. And you can see that that increased with standard DBT and with DBT ACEs, and we are very happy to see that it was maintained even after they left the program. Standard DBT tends to do all of the things with us that it does in other treatment programs, so there's a drastic drop in some of the important indicators of top DBT targets, so ER visits came down, but they also there wasn't much farther to go, but came down more in the DBT ACEs year and then went up just a little bit there in the follow-up. Yeah? This sample's a 30, I think. Inpatient psychiatric admissions, the same. Medically treated self-inflicted injuries also. So we really saw that we could, you know, help folks to maintain those gains that they made in the standard DBT year. So having said all that, what is it? Okay. So primarily DBT ACEs, which stands for Accepting the Challenges of Exiting the System, it used to be something, I can't remember what, but it spelled SLAP. So we decided not to go with that. And I like that accepting the challenges of exiting the system really captures a lot of the sides of the dialectic we're trying to capture. It is primarily a DBT program. So it has the same DBT target hierarchy, the same modes and functions, same acceptance change in dialectical balance focus, same treatment strategy, same movement speed and flow. So it really looks very, very similar to other DBT programs. We have a very specific goal, however. So for those of you who are familiar with DBT specialty programs, one of the things about a DBT specialty program is that a person's coming in saying, this is particularly what I want. And when we started out, we just sort of had this as a second year of DBT. And we said, this is our goal, a life worth living outside the social service system. It means the ability to live outside successfully without continuous psychosocial treatment and off psychiatric disability payments despite life's inevitable setbacks. Not everybody has this goal. You know, about 50% of folks who start our standard DBT program enter ACEs, right? So about part of that is there's a bunch of folks who drop out in standard DBT, right? So just similar to any other DBT program. But also there's folks where this is not what's important to them, that it's not important to them to get off of psychiatric disability or go back to work for myriads of different reasons. We've had folks who are 60 years old, they're thinking, really? Are you kidding? At this point? No, not going to happen. We've had folks who, for whatever reason, in terms of managing their children, managing their lives, one way or another, this has just not been their focus. So over time, we actually really separated this from standard DBT, and everybody graduates standard DBT after the standard 12 months, and then you can apply for the DBT ACES program. So we really separated them because we saw that some people were saying just because they felt there was more and they should finish, right, when they actually don't share this goal, right? And you don't want people working on a goal that isn't theirs in any DBT program. So how did we adapt it? So the first adaptation we made is to targeting. So like other specialty programs, like substance abuse programs or eating disorder programs in DBT, you want to maintain the same general hierarchy, which means life-threatening behaviors and therapy-interfering behaviors always remain the top targets. What we've adapted is to say, among all quality of life-interfering targets, we are asking that you select the DBT recovery targets that I'm going to teach you about as your top priority, and that you're going to put your focus on that as opposed to the myriad other things that you could choose to work on. And that makes us a little bit different, and we kind of do some commitment work at the beginning to be sure this is really what people want. It's very important to know that people kind of really understand what it's going to mean, because we push people pretty hard in our DBT ACES program, and again, I just don't like to push people hard when we're, unless it's their goals we're going after. So you should have in your packet, sort of toward the end of my section, a DBT self-assessment. And what I've done is sort of edit the self-assessment our participants in our DBT ACES program complete to be more general so that you all can fill it out. So what I'd like people to do is think about somebody in your life who is psychiatrically disabled. This could be a family member, this could be yourself, this could be a client, this could be anybody, it doesn't matter who it is. And I want you to answer each of these questions using this scale, and I'll kind of go through them with you, for that person. So we've modified a scale that's standard on the DBT diary card in most DBT programs that goes from 0 to 7, with the idea that what we're trying to do is get to kind of skills, in this case recovery target mastery. So 7 is, I do or have this reliably, this problem is essentially solved, right? Working your way back to things in 4s and 5s, I try to do it, I can do it, I have done it, but it's not a reliable thing. Down to, I haven't tried it at all, down to, I've thought about it, but I didn't take any action. So it's also a little bit kind of like you might see some of the motivational interviewing kind of ideas of stages of change, right? So they complete this as part of their initial assessment, and they complete it quarterly as we go through our program. And then we in the DBT consultation team review this with their individual therapist to make sure their individual therapist is on it for these targets, because we have way more targets in DBT ACEs than you would normally see in a standard DBT program. So let's go through them. So the first category, and just fill them out with me as we go, is living wage employment and being off psychiatric disability. So the first thing is you have to be able to choose a career path to living wage employment, knowing it fits with your wise mind values and talents, as well as practical issues. Pay, health insurance, leave, retirement benefits, hours, shift times, and everything else, right? The second is being able to demonstrate that you have a capability to financially support yourself and your family in your chosen career. So we want you to pick a career, and we want you to have the inherent capacity to do whatever it is that you have selected. But we also want you to demonstrate capability to financially support yourself in at least one fallback job without psychiatric disability payments or other people's income. Because one of the things you have to remember is if you're going to give up the cash payment that comes every month from a disability payment, and you're going to feel confident that you will not end up homeless, you have to be able to get a job really quickly and do it. So if your chosen career is a teacher and there's some reason why you lose that job, can you get out there and work? Because if you can't, you should naturally feel reluctant to give up disability payments. Does that make sense? You have to have enough health insurance, right? So if you give up disability payments, that's something that will tend to go with it. So you got to solve that problem. And you have to have better than 90% follow-through on attendance, being on time, appropriate dress and manner, following directions, etc. Because if you don't, you may end up one of those people who has a job, but you're sort of the person in the corner that kind of doesn't get fired but never gets a promotion. And this is way too much work for anybody to settle for that. We want our folks getting promotions, getting, you know, being able to make a lateral move or other move to have more money, more promotions, all the things all of us want in our jobs. Next thing is interpersonal proficiency. So the main reason people can't get jobs or lose jobs is not because they can't do that job. It's because of interpersonal issues on the job. So we make this a major focus, the DBT ACES program. They have to be interpersonally easy to work with. They have to be able to regulate their emotional expression and actions in interpersonal situations, even with difficult people. They have to know their wise mind limits. So one of the things about DBT skills in general, not just ACEs, is DBT skills are superb employment skills. As Cedar Coons has shown in her work with vocational rehab, they're really excellent work skills. So I have a lot of folks who go to work as part of the DBT ACEs program, and their bosses love them, and they end up with way too many shifts, and they get overwhelmed. So we have to teach folks how, if you turn out to be somebody's favorite employee, how are you going to rein that in and not essentially end up totally overwhelmed? And again, receiving praise, raises, and promotions. We really want people to have a nice life outside of work. These categories are expected to overlap. These aren't different people. But we want to make sure people have friends whose values align with theirs, that they have at least one person or group for casual interactions, at least one close support with whom they can experience intimacy and discuss private issues who is not their therapist, and have at least one local person or group who would notice if they were not around. If you've had a history of depression, it is critical, as someone who has had a history of depression, it is critical to me to be in environments where if I withdraw, somebody notices. Because if you don't catch that early, it is a hell of a road back up. So we really feel that's important. We want people to be an active member of an organized recreational activity that might be either fun or meaningful. So it doesn't, you know, it's value or positivity. To disengage from relationships with family members that are ineffective or destructive, and disengage with friendships that are ineffective or destructive. So recognizing that there's some relationships that are either closer than is manageable. You know, I have some folks who do have such improved relationships now that they only see their family members at restaurants, for instance, where for both sides that little bit of distance has made an enormous difference. There's other folks where what ends up happening is they go from being kind of the identified patient in their family to being kind of the identified therapist in their family. And again, I think a lot of that has to do with basic DBT skills, and often, again, you have to sort of help folks to be able to manage that whole change process. I mean, things change and relationships change, and everybody has to kind of adjust to whoever the new, as everybody changes in a relationship, both the patient, family, other folks. We want to make sure that people are choosing their relationships based on evidence that they're compatible in lifestyle needs and values, as opposed to impulsive responses to that, you know, rush of love and excitement that you feel. We're not against that. We just don't want that to be the sole reason our clients are developing relationships. And we want folks to have an effective and rewarding romantic relationship if they want one. We're really aware of the importance of self-sufficiency. Most of my patients are very, very good at managing their budget in terms of the social services and disability world in which they live. But it's different than managing outside of that system. I mean, most of us actually would do a terrible job of managing in the system because we don't know how to do that. Same is true the other way. So we want them to have a budget. We want them to have enough savings. I really look for the 3 months. I think 3 months is the minimum to find a job. These days, it's kind of more like 6, unfortunately, with our recession. But if you don't have that kind of backup, it's hard to imagine giving up your disability payments when you don't have something to fall back on. Fortunately for a lot of folks, as they start to work, at first people don't, you kind of hang on to your disability payments while you're working at first, and we really try to help people figure out how to do this and how to manage things like if you have too much cash, then they take it away or they change your rent or whatever. We've had some people do things like pay their rent in advance so that the money, they don't have the money, but they have secured their housing. I mean, so we try to come up with creative solutions to all of these issues and make sure that they can manage their time. We want to make sure they can prevent other psychiatric symptoms and chronic illness and pain from having a huge impact on their life. And finally, emotional proficiency. It is DBT, so of course emotional proficiency is very important. We want them to be able to experience their negative emotions as they build, as they stay, and as they fall in a mindful way, not avoiding or rushing them along or mentally moving into a different moment. The same with positive emotions, and with problematic emotions, we want them to be able to get them down. Many folks have learned a lot of this in the standard DBT year, so often this is sort of generalization rather than learning in terms of acquisition. It's helping them generalize them to all the environments that they have to go to. So essentially, you can't necessarily achieve all of these targets in 12 months. So we use that scale that I gave you in that questionnaire. We ask them folks to fill it out because there's a bunch of these things folks will know even when they come in, so that they and their therapist can kind of hone in on which are the ones that are most problematic and which are the ones that the client is most committed to working on first. Picking whichever ones you're going to go after, they're the basis for targeting in the DBTA is individual therapy. And we do, like I said, quarterly reassessment by the client and a review in team with the therapist to make sure they're targeting the right things and what the client thinks they're targeting and what the therapist thinks they're targeting are actually aligned, which does not you can slide off of it actually pretty easily. We've adapted the diary card to match these. So, for instance, this is the top of our diary card in its newest version. So we have people identify their primary ambition. And we maintain having suicidal ideation or self-harm on the diary card if this is a history, because we don't want it to kind of reappear without our well awareness as a therapist. But you can see we stick it at the bottom of the list. And then the blanks are, you know, we all have an online, you know, file version of this, and we edit this to be specific for the client. And then we have, instead of all the DBT skills, we've taken the recovery targets and turned them into items that people can rate on a daily or weekly basis. So we have whether they're doing their homework every day, living wage, employment, building community, self-sufficiency, emotional proficiency, et cetera. So we ask people to track all of this every day. Or the ones that have the long bar, we don't think they make sense to rate every day. They rate them once a week. So that's the first adaption, is the whole targeting, which has really greatly shaped what we do. The second is our skills curriculum. So this is a general format of our skills curriculum. We do a check-in at the beginning, homework review, and then new material. So this is our check-in. So the first thing that people have to be able to identify is an ambition or a goal. What am I passionate to achieve? Right, so I have clients who want to be a radiology tech. I have clients who want to get control of their anxiety so that they can enjoy their weekends. Right, we have a wide range. People want to lose weight. You know, whatever it is, the point is we want to teach them to be their own therapist. We want them to teach them to have an ambitious goal, and then to be able to identify an action step they can do each week that is specifically how they're going to get to that, and an employment step, which I'll come back to later when I talk about our contingencies. So a lot of this does a brilliant job, actually, of helping people be able to learn essentially behavior therapy and become their own behavior therapist. So our goal is that everybody can pick an action step that is the right size step so they can, it's not easy, but they can hit it every time. Because what do we know as behavior therapists is success leads to success. So if you can learn to set an action step right and get that kind of calibrated correctly, and then you hit it, and then you're going to be motivated to do it again next week and next week and next week. So essentially this is kind of our goal. We have people identify what was effective every week. And if they avoided, in other words, they didn't make their action step that week entirely, how did they avoid it and what could they do to prevent that? And everybody in the group does this together. So each client does this and presents it to the group, and the co-leaders participate as well. So in my case, My ambition is to run a 12-minute mile in a 5K. That's my current one. I can't tell you how much exercise my ACES group has gotten me through. It used to be that I could go exercise well enough that I didn't have to say no when friends asked, because I used to be so out of shape I couldn't go anywhere with anybody because I would fall behind, right? So I'm getting more ambitious, right? I'm trying to model ambition. It'll be a long time before I pull this off. And then I have action steps. You know, I'm going to be one of the things is not working outside of my work hours. That has made a huge difference on my exercise. So that's part of my target. And then this week also was that there Monday, Wednesday, and Friday I would do the exercise workout that I had planned. So I come, I present that, I present my progress, I present what I did that was effective, I present any way I may have avoided that, an emotion, I come up with a new one. The whole group's job is to kind of support and be reinforcing to folks as they do this, problem solve with them, and it really is amazing how much this can help. People learn how to be able to think like a behavior therapist. Also, if somebody reports an effective behavior every single week, it gets harder and harder not to do it, right? So I had a client for whom scheduling was her, you know, how did you pull this off? What was effective? I scheduled it in my schedule book, right? You keep hearing that week after week, and they're getting it done, and you aren't doing it, and you're not getting yours done. It gets pretty hard not to start scheduling, right? So you start to see scheduling spread out around the group, right? So, you know, these are things that can be really helpful in a group context. We go through the skills. This is the list of all the modules. Each module is 1 month. We go through the DBT skills from the first year one more time, but really all applied. We don't use the same handouts again, and then you can see we have a number of other topics. The third thing that's often where people have a lot of strong feelings as clients and therapists in my DBT program is contingency management. So a lot of really what DBT ACEs is exposure and contingency management. We are exposing people to their fears of going back to work, their fears of being off disability, and we're setting up contingencies to make sure that people actually do. And we've kind of developed this through long, hard practice of having things not work. But also, boy, you talk about behavior therapy. I have to say my ACEs clients have really reinforced us for lifting the bar. Because we keep raising the bar and they keep jumping over it, we keep getting reinforced for raising the bar. So what we do is we have a slow shaping curve. So it starts in standard DBT. So when you come into a standard DBT, the first year of treatment, we ask that you get active and that you're active and engaging in normative productive activity. And you can see sort of building from 10 to 15 to 20 hours. Whoops. And what does that mean? It means that you're doing things that are normative, so you act as if you don't have emotional problems around other people who are acting as if they don't have emotional problems. So hanging out in our drop-in lounge does not count, because most of the people in our drop-in lounge are not trying to act like they don't have mental and emotional problems. It also has to be productive, structured, active, goal-oriented, rewarding, outside of the mental health system. Right, so already that is one adaptation we really make in the first year, is we want folks out. As Marcia Linehan will tell you, this is, in her mind, this is in standard DBT. We've just sort of made it more concrete. In DBT ACEs, we move this forward with two separate contingencies. The first is living wage career plan. So by 4 months into DBT ACEs, folks have to maintain either paid work, be in college, a VOTEC program, or some kind of self-employment startup 10 hours a week. And by 8 months, they have to maintain this 20 hours a week. So we really want there to be contingencies in place that are going to get people moving on that chosen job or profession. We also have what we've called varying different things. We called it the plain vanilla job requirement. We've called it a lot of stuff. We've now decided the best thing to call it is work as therapy, because it's actually quite helpful not only explaining it to clients but also to the disability folks, that what we want is to make sure that people have the capacity to work, which means we need them working so we can see how it's going. If we can't see how it's going, we can't help you on a work site. We have no idea whether, in fact, you're going to be able to work. And we have occasionally, not always, been able to convince some of the disability folks who would otherwise have pulled somebody's funding to allow them to do this piece of it so that we can make sure that they can work. So what we ask is that in the course of DBT ACEs, or if they already did this in standard DBT, they can, we don't make them do it again. So anywhere in those 2 years, they do 6 months at working at least 10 hours a week at a typical competitive employment job for an employer who files a W-2 for that job. So this is not self-employment, under-the-table work, pickup work, illegal work, of course, contracts, consulting, etc. We want to know that if your career, which could include any of those things, but if it failed, if something went wrong, you know, we hit a recession in 2009, whatever it is, you can get out there, you can find work, and you can make the job work for you. And if you know that and you have those skills, it is so much easier to move forward in letting your disability payments fade away. It also counts toward the living wage career requirements, not in addition. So 20 hours is always the max that we ever ask anybody to do in the DBT ACEs program, because sometimes people's lives are pretty complicated. Some people have medical problems, children at home, other things. So we don't require more than 20. That being said, we have lots of folks who are working 30 or 40 hours a week. Just as I said, particularly since the recession, we have really focused ourselves in on the finding a job as much as doing the job, because we're finding that that's actually the area people need more help, is how do you get yourself a job, than it is actually how to do a job. So what happens if you don't do this? Oh, well, let me just also say, you have to continue to not harm yourself or have a lot of therapy interfering behaviors. That just goes without saying in a DBT program. You need to maintain those 20 hours a week of normative productive activity, but the career thing is essentially replacing that time. It's not in addition. And this is how we have them track it on their diary cards. So we're really tracking the applications submitted, interviews, and other contacts about jobs, because we're realizing this is where folks need a lot of help. And let me just clarify that if you don't meet these contingencies, the workers therapy contingency or the living wage career plan contingency, then you go on what in DBT is generally called a therapy vacation. We actually call it a suspension in our program, because vacation, the clients thought, was really weird. It didn't seem like a vacation to them. So you're out of our DBT program until you have 1 week at meeting whatever it is. So, for instance, in this case, if it was a work therapy requirement, as soon as you've worked 10 hours for 1 week, you're back in. So we really want to make treatment available. But what we only have this 1 year with them, and we don't want them to spend it on time when they aren't working. We want to save it for when they are, because there's so much of what DBT ACEs is doing, and particularly what their individual therapy is about, that requires them to be on the job, to actually be doing it. And we don't want them to we don't want them to use up all that treatment time without the job and then have to go to a job without help, without any of those things troubleshooting. So what do you do in individual therapy? You pretty much do DBT. You use the recovery goals. We use the diary card. We develop commitment to work and leaving community mental health and disability, starting usually about 6 months into the first year. We're kind of on to this now. We monitor things, trying to keep to the shaping curve, and as in any DBT program, it's all about reinforcing every bit of progress that you see. We do a lot of formal and informal exposure to the fears that folks have of leaving work, of starting to work and leaving disability. Obviously, we don't want to expose them to fears that make sense, so we're not going to do that. But there are a lot of fears people have that they, for instance, don't have the capability of holding down a job. We want to show them, in fact, that they do. Or they have a fear they'll never get a job. We want to show them, in fact, that that's not true. And we spend a lot of time blocking avoidance, because every kind of emotionally, you're going to want to retreat from these things often and not lean toward them. In DBT with coaching, it's not really that different from standard DBT, except we keep the bar very high. We expect that standard DBT targets, like I've had a suicidal thought comes into my mind, or I really don't feel like coming to therapy, or things like that, we expect them to handle those independently, right? That's in order to come to the ACEs program, you've got to be able to show you've gone at least 8 weeks with none of these sorts of behaviors so that we know that you can actually do it. We expect you to keep doing that part as much as possible on your own. We will put people on probation if they do have a kind of slip back into suicidal behavior, for instance, And we have had people on suspension if they've continued to kind of slide back, and then they've had to kind of work their way back into the program. What we really want to do is provide coaching for the exposure process of going to work, lots of in vivo practice if we can do it, helping people get out there and collect job applications, et cetera, and obviously taper it off as treatment is ending. Consult team is pretty much exactly the same as standard DBT. The two things we do is at month six of standard DBT, we start to review the client's progress. Does ACEs seem like a likely future for this person? How shall we introduce it? What would they need to accomplish to be competitive for it? And at month 10, we have an application that's due, and the team reviews it. And then, like I said, in the second year, we do these check-ins. So that's kind of where the DBT ACEs program is. So what we're trying to accomplish right now is we have this feasibility trial we're finishing up. We've discovered the design, the way we did it, isn't actually feasible because we decided to randomize people after standard DBT, which turns out to be an incredibly bad idea. It really is not tolerable for the patients to have a sudden randomization midway through. And so many of our deadlines 4 months into DBT ACEs require that you have a strong relationship with your therapist, and having a changed therapist just really, people don't have the relationship to sustain that kind of. So we're looking at different designs for a future NIMH trial. We're working on the skills curriculum, and we're starting a DBT listserv for colleagues at other sites who have been developing the DBT ACEs model at their site. And lastly, I just want to acknowledge everyone at Harborview for all the help that we've had over the years in developing this, as well as Marcia and the Behavioral Research and Therapy Clinics. Thank you. Do you have two questions? Does anybody have any questions? Time for a few questions if people have them. Yeah. Personal. So the question is, what about personal kind of self-hygiene and getting medical care? If you can't maintain good personal hygiene, I don't think we would accept you into the DBT ACEs program. I think we would be worried that you need some help with some really basic skills. We do, and we would rather you. The other thing about the DBT ACEs program is that we, hang on a second. Okay, so the other thing that we really want to do in the DBT ACEs program is we kind of tell everybody if they've done the full first year with us and they want to do the DBT ACEs program, but this isn't the time either by their choice or because they really have more work to do, they can take a break and come back to us. And that would be the kind of thing where if at the end of the year they still couldn't manage basic hygiene and community living, I'd probably say just keep working, keep doing what you're doing. So, like, I have a patient right now who is graduating this week, she's only 19 now, and due to some physical disabilities that she has really not had much chance to learn how to be an independent adult. She's always been highly taken care of, and we agreed between us, she and I, that the DBT ACEs program is in her future, but probably not right away, because this would be a lot of pressure when she isn't even going out by herself regularly, that sort of thing, getting herself about independently. And we do mostly try to target chronic illness and pain as is one of our DBT ACEs targets. So if somebody's got, we have patients with fibromyalgia, we have patients with chronic abdominal problems, other kind of physical illnesses, and what we're trying to do is to teach people to be able to kind of function despite, right, so that they get higher quality of life even if we can't cure the underlying problem. Yeah?
At the check-in where they talk about their ambition, is that an ongoing ambition, or does that flow from their recovery goals?
Usually it flows from their recovery goals, and it's really quite variable. What we really try to do is teach people to go after an ambition in the way that it motivates them. So for some people, they have an ambition that's pretty broad. I would like to be trying to think of a conglomeration of people, so I'm not sharing anything. I would like to be living on my own in an apartment, dating, have a lot of friends who support me, and I'm working full-time in a job that I love. Right? Okay, that's a pretty big, wide goal, right? Other people will say things like, I want to get enrolled in school. And how far and how big and versus how small, we're trying to teach folks to be able to match that to who they are. So some people are much more motivated by something concrete and close that they can achieve, and then they have a new one. Other people are more motivated by the kind of bigger vision. So we teach people to go with the thing that motivates them. Yeah, so that it actually doesn't happen that often, but it does occasionally happen that people don't have this idea of a stable ambition. And we do say, hey, the idea with your ambition is it should be regularly the same until you've achieved it, or until you've realized that it's a vision that isn't yours.
Questions will come this way.
Great.
When they don't, can you repeat them?
Sure. Do you want me to answer this one now, or? Okay. Let me take a hand and then, yeah. Go ahead. It really depends on the client's context. So we've had some folks where we've had a fair amount of involvement with their family. In DBT, we really are trying to keep the primary relationship between the therapist and the client, but we've often had family members coming in, you know, a couple times during the year talking about what the plan is. And we spend a lot of time helping the clients be able to sort of speak for themselves with their family and not kind of feel like they have to go through us or that we need to be involved in that. And then depending on how much the client wants family involved, we have had family doing lots of the kind of footwork with them and often spending a lot more time with them. If one of their goals is to spend time with family, then we really support that and try to get the family. Well, our goal is really that family play the job of family. So for a lot of my clients, family have been in much more of kind of a case manager, crisis manager role, and we really want to get rid of that. We want them to have family relationships with family, so we encourage them to do the things that other folks in their family do. Yeah. Go ahead, Brett. Let's see. So I would say it's a kind of complicated answer. In terms of Access 1 disorders, we've had a lot of folks with a wide range of Access 1 disorders. We don't particularly sort of recruit people or not recruit people on that basis. People who have a significant thought disorder that really is sort of the dominant problem for them, we actually run a separate program for them in DBT that's an 18-month program. We've occasionally had folks who, in that course of that program, really got a real handle on their cognitive difficulties or psychotic difficulties or whatever, and then we've moved them over to come. We have somebody starting in April who was in our cognitive track, but who's really substantially changed her baseline around that. But we have found that these kind of deadlines and time-limited, you know, you must do something by 4 months, is not very helpful with somebody with a dominant psychotic disorder, or we used to have people who with really significant manias, and then the mania would sort of take over, and then they really got totally off track. So we've been doing things a little differently for them, and I don't think the clock helps them. Yeah. Can I give an example of a success story? Can I give an example of yours? So we have. What's really successful from our point of view is we often, you know, historically we've really, because of funding, only been able to take the folks who are kind of the highest utilizers in our treatment system in the county, because the county payment for DBT is pretty low unless their folks are at a pretty high acuity level. So we've had folks come in who've been in the hospital repeatedly before they came to standard DBT. Had a lot of psychotic symptoms, a lot of depression, and then over the course of standard DBT really were able to resolve that, and then had someone come, for instance, start working a kind of what we think of as sort of our workers' therapy job as working in a grocery store or a job like that while they're also sort of pursuing their goals, which may not be entirely to work in a grocery store, but who also really, improve their relationships with family, improve their relationships with friends, find a partner. These are kind of all the things that we look to see. So I'm just going to answer this question, and I think I'll stop. Oh, yeah. How do we envision applying something like ACEs in a community mental health setting? I would say it really comes down to dollars and cents. Biggest problem for us is the public mental health system in this environment. It's just difficult to have this much therapy provided with, often people have very, very high caseloads. So usually it's really a financial question. But also a lot of people ask me about ACEs and they're thinking it's kind of like just like an aftercare group, right? And often when I sort of explain everything that's involved, people are like, oh, I'm not sure if that's really what I'm getting into. So I think that's the thing. People just have to understand that ACEs is really at least as time intensive as a standard DBT program. And so it's in mental health, it really depends if you can support those resources. And I'll end there. Thank you.